A very warm welcome to all of our listeners this afternoon. You are listening to Professor David Block and our show this afternoon at cliffcentral.com is entitled Looking Up with David Block. And I think that as we have such special guests in our studio each week, the key theme is always one of never looking down, but rather of seeing the bigger picture, the mystery in the cosmos, the enigma, the stories to unfold in your life and mine. But one of the stories, and please remember that I've been at the University of the Witwatersrand for about 30 years now, but one of the stories that has really captivated my attention over the years has been a very, very interesting little beetle. And connected to the beetle is my subject of interest and research, and that is the stars. Beetles and the stars. Well, you might be thinking of the Beatles, the famous pop group that were very famous when I grew up as a very young boy. But I'm not talking about those sorts of Beatles at all. My guest today will unfold an extraordinary story in space and in cosmic time to us. His name is Professor Marcus Byrne. Professor Marcus Byrne has his BSc Honours, London, and his doctorate from the University of the Witwatersrand, where he is a professor of entomology. Now, in introducing Marcus today to our global audience, whether you be here in South Africa or listening or podcasting from Chicago, we're going to unfold one of the most incredible stories of beetles and the stars, tiny little beetles and the gargantuan microcosm and the gargantuan macrocosm. It is an extraordinary story which I find and trust you will also find riveting today. So, Marcus, a very, very warm welcome to you at cliffcentral.com.
Thanks, David, and thanks for the invitation.
It's really a great joy. I know we've waited several weeks, if not a few months, to have you here due to your schedule, but it's absolutely awesome for us to have you here in studio today with Duncan, who is our sound engineer. Now, of course, Marcus, South Africa often doesn't occupy, in the world of science, central stage. If we think of, for example, the world of soccer, yes, FIFA World Cup, everybody was flying to South Africa, and South Africa was really central focus. The burial of Nelson Mandela again. The world was focused on South African soil and shores. But as a scientist, I mean, let's be honest. You and I are not working at Yale or at Harvard, and yet I've always felt very privileged to be a South African doing science. How do you actually view, remembering that most of our listeners are 25 years and younger, how would you view the concept of doing science in South Africa, Marcus?
I think that's a great question, because you're right. We often, I think as South Africans, tend to be apologetic about what we are and what we're doing. Mm. And we're always, we have an inferiority complex to some degree. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we should. Mm-hmm. Because we do world-class science. We publish in international journals. So we're publishing with our peers at Yale and at Harvard. And we're getting our work out with theirs shoulder to shoulder. And for me, the joy of being here is, one is the people here are just incredible to
work
with.
They are, aren't they? Yes.
Then it's the environment. You know, we couldn't do this work that we do on dung beetles, certainly in Europe. It would be difficult in America. Possibly South America is about the only place you could do it. Even Australia couldn't do it.
Yes.
And I work with Swedish colleagues on this work, and they come all the way from Sweden to do this work here.
So, in other words, there are teams of international collaborators with whom you work. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes. So there's people from Sweden that I'm doing this orientation work on.
Mm-hmm.
People from Harvard and Max Planck Institute. We're looking at dung beetle digestion, believe it or not, because we don't really know what dung beetles eat. And then I've also got a collaborator at the State University in Colorado where we're working on alien weeds, believe it or not.
Now, Marcus, I would love you to take us down a journey of the following. You've been using the words, and so eloquently so, the concept of the dung beetle. But let's just imagine, say, someone in Alaska, and they're sitting there now, and it's pretty cold, and they're near the Arctic Circle, and they just do not have the foggiest idea of what a dung beetle might be. Or someone in Norway, for example, you know, at Sommerøy at 70 degrees north, the concept of dung and dung beetle would be totally foreign to someone listening to us, for example, in Japan. Could you describe carefully and slowly to all of our listeners, including myself, exactly what distinguishes the species of dung beetles and what do they do?
Okay. It's a huge question.
It's a big question. So just take your time.
Yeah. So again, living in this country, we are absolutely overwhelmed with the number of insect species that are available to us.
How many do we have approximately?
We don't know. We haven't a clue. Yes. 60% of the species in this country don't even have a name. So that's virgin snow.
That's incredible. 60% do not even have a name.
Yeah. So, so we estimate we've got 90,000 to over 100,000 species of insects in
this
incredible.
Country.
And in the world, insects are the most species group of organisms. So there are more species of insects than trees, than plants, than bacteria, than fish, than birds. So this is the planet of the insects.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so forget, I always tell my students, forget Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. The body plan for this planet is to be a beetle, because of the insects, the beetles are the most numerous.
Yes.
So it's clearly an incredibly successful body structure.
Yes.
So it's a basic insect, which means it's got three body parts. It's got a head, a middle bit, which we call the thorax, and an abdomen, which is the back bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's got three pairs of legs and an external skeleton. Mm-hmm. And we think that's its key to its success, is that it's this hard little packet that can hide away pretty much anywhere. It could, you could almost have beetles. You may even have beetles hiding in this studio somewhere.
Yes.
But then tucked under those hard outer wing covers, beetles have a membranous pair of wings that allows them to fly.
Yes.
So not only can they hide in hundreds of places, they can also move pretty much wherever they like. So that's the beetles. And then within the beetles, the dung beetles, worldwide there are about 6,000 species of dung beetles worldwide.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in fact, even in Scandinavia, in Sweden, they have four species of dung beetles.
Mm-hmm.
Where we've got 800 species of dung beetles, which I always enjoy. People say they went to the game reserve and they saw a giraffe and an elephant and a lion and a dung beetle. No, you didn't. You saw one of potentially 800 species of dung beetles. And ecologically, they are an incredibly important group because they clean up the mess.
You know, so could you explain to someone perhaps who hasn't had the privilege of visiting South Africa, going, for example, to the Kruger National Park or some of our other famous parks, They might, you know, even the concept, for example, of, you know, a lion grazing to a city dweller in Tokyo is perhaps, or in China, is perhaps extremely foreign to them. Could you describe, I mean, okay, we've got dung now. What do these beetles do? You mentioned they clean up. Do they actually roll up balls of dung? Could you describe this dung process to us?
Yeah, so you're right. Nobody really needs me to describe the dung, but because we tend to ignore it and just hope that it goes away. And that's really what these guys do, is that they make it go away. And basically, there's two ways in which they remove dung. One is the visible way, which South Africans will be aware of, where they do roll it into a transportable package. And basically, what they're doing is they're getting a big slice of the cake. And there's two ways to eat your cake. You can stand at the cake counter and eat it, but then you've got to fight everybody else for your slice. Right. Or you grab the biggest piece you can and you run away with it and hide it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what the ball rollers do. Mm-hmm. But however, they are in a minority. So of our 800 species, only about 80 of them, so only about 10% actually roll balls. The other 90%, yes, actually you never see. Unless you're prepared to get poo under your fingernails and poke around in the poo, you will never see those beetles because they fly directly into the dung.
Yes.
And then they tunnel down below it, and then they shuttle back and forth between the surface of the soil.
That's extraordinary.
And they make a nest. Mm-hmm. And in that nest, they pack away. An elephant dropping can be packed away by a pair of very large beetles during the course of a night. Mm-hmm. And in the summer, which is, we're on the edge of summer now, we had that beautiful rain over the weekend, the beetles will come out now, and they'll start packing away poo at an incredible rate.
So from the site, for example, you've got, say, poo somewhere in the Kruger National Park, how far would they roll these balls? Is it meters or tens of meters, or is it more?
Yeah, it depends. The tunnelers will go directly beneath it and can tunnel up to a meter beneath the dung.
That's extraordinary.
The rollers can literally roll it, say, 5, 10 centimeters or 30 meters.
Or 30 meters.
Yeah. And it really just depends on what takes their fancy. And that suggests that beetles are clever little guys that can make decisions like you and I. They can weigh factors to make a choice between things, and in fact they can't. It's more like they have a set of switches that drop when a certain stimulus is given to them.
I see.
So for instance, they could roll up against a rock or a tuft of grass, and that would be stimulus to then bury the dung at that point.
I see.
If they're on an open field and we do this experiment with them, we actually take them into the middle of a hockey pitch, of an astroturf, and we plonk them down and let them roll, and they will roll, and they just keep going until they find somewhere to make their nest.
So in other words, they don't communicate one with another, as you say. It's more robotically in terms of switching?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's, as far as we're aware, there are no social dung beetles, so there's no communication between them at all. But even in terms of their concept of the world around them, they're not particularly aware creatures because they've got such tiny brains. Their brain is about 350,000 neurons. Yours and my brain are literally hundreds of billions of neurons. And so they just don't have the brain power to make decisions and make choices. But nevertheless, they are little automatons that are able to appear clever because they switch on and off when they have the right stimulus.
So in other words, here is this poo. Let's just be very basic. Here is this poo, for example, elephant dung, for example, and here these beetles come and start rolling the dung into balls. Now, before going into the way they do this, do they do this at during the day or at night? And we'll go into the orientation in a moment. But, I mean, do they start rolling balls on a 24/7 basis, or is it preferentially done at night?
Well, again, the issue here is that dung is a tight market.
Yes.
And you have to be a specialist.
I love that.
And if you want to
dung is a tight market. That's lovely.
Well, you know, you think about it. Go and look for some. And yes. then you'll realize how usually rare it is, because yes. it's ephemeral. It doesn't last very long.
No, that's true.
And
that's
it's true. And it's patchy. It comes in little blobs across the landscape. Mm. So when you find a blob, you have to work it.
It's like gold.
In a sense.
Yes.
Because it is for these animals, because that's the vehicle that they're going to get their genes into the next generation on. And in evolutionary terms, that's the future. You've got to get your genes into the next generation.
Yes.
So yes, they find the dung, and they generally work at a specific time of day. So of the 800 species, they've literally sliced the day into different periods of activity.
I see.
So there'll be some species which are day flyers.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some species which are night flyers,
mm-hmm.
and there are some species which are dusk flyers. And in fact, mm-hmm. some of the species that fly at dusk mm-hmm. literally have a 30-minute window in which they can be active. And if the elements don't conspire to be perfect for them in terms of light and heat at that point, they won't be active. And they then will sit the night out, and they'll wait again for their 30-minute window the next day.
It's incredible.
So again, beautiful nature that it slices up the 24 hours
yes.
into periods of activity depending on what your speciality yes. is as a beetle.
You are listening to Professor David Block, and I have the singular honor and joy this afternoon of interviewing Professor Marcus Byrne from the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg here in South Africa. He's professor of entomology. He is world famous regarding the dung beetle. And it's an extraordinary story. We've only just started. It's going to be the most remarkable story to unfold. The world of dung, but the world of gold. The world of something which we might call, as in Winnie the Pooh, poo. And something which is absolutely stellar in content, as of a diamond. Should you wish to contact us in studio here in Rivonia today, our studio number is 0861 555 189. The Twitter handle is at cliffcentral.com. The WeChat ID is Cliff Central. The Facebook ID is Cliff Central. And if you wish to reach us on Instagram, reach us at handle at Cliff Central. I know we have people such as Tracy listening in today, and many multitudes of others. Do call in. Ask your questions on 0861 555 189. We have a question just before we go to a little music break from Gary, and Gary wants to know, do dung beetles only eat or specialize in dung, or is it only just one of the dietary elements they feast upon?
Okay, so a great question. Again, it tends to be a degree of specialization, but not as much as the literature says. So there's a lot of literature that says the Addo elephant dung beetle, which you may have seen, it's a beautiful flightless animal that walks around, walking from one pile of elephant dung to the next.
Yes.
They don't just live on elephant dung. They can actually survive on human dung. They can survive on pig dung, horse dung, cow dung.
I see.
But nevertheless, dung is actually part of a continuum. It's think of grass at one end and think of a dead body at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a continuum of detritus, that it's basically the dead stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so the majority of dung beetles have settled on excrement, dung.
Mm-hmm.
But some species actually eat grass, so they cut it and they roll it into balls and make it into a little ball.
I see.
And at the other end, there are some species that eat carrion, so they eat dead animals. And they will slice bits off a dead animal, or even bury a small dead animal like a mouse, and use that as a food source.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite species is, we've got seven species in this country, that they actually eat millipedes.
Hmm.
So the big shongalolos, and it's the most hilarious thing you've ever seen. So instead of trying to roll this thing into a ball, which they can't, they sort of push this huge sausage along the ground, bury it, and they use it for food, and they use it as a breeding source, and a source of food for their offspring.
So in other words, to answer Gary's question, the answer that they only specialize in dung is no. You have this wide spectrum of dietary interests regarding the beetles. We're going to take a short music break. We're going to, I believe, Duncan will tell us we are going to be playing some of my favorite music today, that of Antonio Vivaldi and the Four Seasons. Sit back and relax for the next 2 to 3 minutes as we take you through one of those incredible seasons while the dung beetles do their poo business on that pale blue dot which Carl Sagan dubbed as being the Earth. You are listening to Professor David Block. The broadcast is entitled Looking Up with David Block. To reach us in studio, the number is 0861 555 189, and the WeChat, which is the favorite way of reaching me, is Cliff Central. I'm at www.davidblock.co.za, and my Twitter handle is this, at Starry Galaxy Man, at Starry Galaxy Man. We are dealing with an extraordinary story today, and in studio here in Rivonia is the world of dung beetles. In fact, we have a whole selection of them crawling about in the studio, and my guest today is a world-renowned expert in the subject of beetles, but now, Professor Marcus Byrne, but now I want Marcus to start taking us on the most enigmatic journey, and that's the following, one which has captivated my attention for many years now, and that is the fact that beetles don't just navigate in some arbitrary way. Marcus.
Thanks. In fact, none of us do. Any organism that wants to move across the planet in a straight line has to do so with reference to an external object.
Yes, good.
If you close your eyes and block your ears and try and walk in a straight line, you will either hurt yourself or walk around in a great big circle.
Mm-hmm.
And so you and I navigate by landmarks. So mm-hmm. humans are principally landmark navigators. Mm-hmm. You have an internal map of the external world in your head. You know where the shops are. You know where the mm-hmm. church is. You know where the supermarket is. Mm-hmm. And you move through that map physically and mentally.
Yes.
And that requires a lot of brain power because you need to be able to build a map. And then you need to be able to locate yourself in it at any given point. Mm-hmm. And some of us are not very good at that. So mm-hmm. I made it to the studio today by benefit of a navigator, a GPS, because I'm absolutely awful at mm. internal maps. But nevertheless, a lot of insects are also very good navigators, and they need to move in a straight line, but they don't have the brain power to build internal maps. Mm. Plus, they don't live long enough. They are throwaway organisms. They have very short life cycles.
What is the typical life cycle of, for example, the dung beetle?
It's like the answer to the previous question. It depends.
And typically, in Gaussian spread?
Yeah, a small guy, probably about 6 weeks to...
I see, so very, very short time.
Yeah, to the big ones, 3 years.
I see, all right.
So, but nevertheless, they are still disposable organisms. Mm-hmm. And so what they do is they use celestial cues.
Now that's listeners where we're starting, where the rubber hits the road. I mean, this is extraordinary. Here we have a little guy, and we've got a couple of little guys in studio, and our guest Marcus Byrne is just telling us that there's a celestial link to the eyes, to the receptors of these beetles, which involve the celestial sphere. Marcus, tell us more.
So, as you know, there are a couple of large bodies that float through our sky on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So the sun is obviously the principal one for the day-active beetles.
Yes.
And they, basically what they do is they can see it. They probably can't resolve it very well because their eyes are not particularly accurate. Mm-hmm. But what they do, they'll hold it in a particular quarter of their vision. So say they would hold the sun at 90 degrees to themselves. They imagine that the sun is off to the right. And if I keep the sun on my right, I can travel in a straight line for hundreds of kilometers without deviating. Mm-hmm. And if I want to do it even for longer, I obviously need a clock to mm-hmm. compensate for the mm-hmm. movement of that. Mm-hmm. So then the nocturnal species don't have the sun, but they can use the moon. Mm-hmm. And we've tested that, and we've shown that beetles need these cues. And the simplest experiment we've done is literally put a little cap on them.
Yes.
So how do you ask a dung beetle, yes. are you using the sun?
Yes.
It's dead easy.
Yes.
You put a cap on it.
Yes.
So the eyes are still functional.
Yes.
But it can't see that celestial object.
Yes.
And then it walks around in a circle.
Amazing.
Yeah. So it's amazing. Very simple experiment.
But now, Marcus, I'm most interested to know what happens, say, in the months of June. Because listeners around the world, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, we have the blazing Via Lactea, the way. Via, the way. Lactea, lacteus, the milk. And we've got this extraordinary stretch, the starry vault of 100,000 million blazing stars. And I've been reading an incredible story wherein Marcus Byrne is occupying central stage with regard to beetles, dung beetles, navigating by means of the Milky Way. You must please enlighten our listeners on this topic.
Well, it was one of those serendipitous moments where we'd been working on nocturnal species and we'd been using the moon mm-hmm. and doing our little experiment with caps on, caps off. And you can also mirror the moon or mirror the sun, so you can change the angle that it comes at to the beetle up to 180 degrees and watch mm-hmm. how they respond. So we had this clear message that, yes, they are using the moon. Then, of course, the moon rises and sets. Mm-hmm. So after the moon went down one night, we were sitting in the field, congratulating ourselves, having a beer and looking up at this beautiful Milky Way, as you said. Mm. And we thought, they must be able to see that. There's no way that they cannot see that beautiful strip of stars across the sky. Mm. Now, we knew that they couldn't resolve the stars, because their eyes actually aren't as accurate as ours. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine them using a pixel size of about the size of your index finger, mm-hmm. fingernail held at arm's length.
Mm-hmm.
So sitting across the studio like this, I could recognize you because you're probably about 20, 30 pixels.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at somebody outside the studio, their face would be about 2 pixels.
Of course.
So you can't resolve those faces. And it's the same for the beetle. They can't resolve the stars.
Mm-hmm.
But what they will see is this smear of light, this mm-hmm. brilliant light across the mm-hmm. sky.
Being the Milky Way.
Yeah, and that's the external cue that they can then use. If they've got a fixed point in the sky, then they can go anywhere they like.
So now, let's just take the example. You're in the Bushveld. You're in the bush, the African bush, the vibrant African bush. And you place the beetles, or you're watching the beetles, and the Milky Way is, say, arching across the sky. Do they actually follow the direction of the arching light?
Generally not. So the whole issue is having a fixed point.
I see.
And then
a point of reference.
Yeah, and they can go to it or away from it or an angle to it.
I see.
So it itself is not taking them all in one direction.
No.
And that would actually be counterintuitive, because if you think about it really
is.
What they're trying to do is avoid each other,
mm-hmm.
because someone's going to steal their piece of cake.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they're all heading off in the same direction, they're going to get into a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to disperse from a central point using a fixed celestial cue is what we've found, is they head off in all directions.
Mm-hmm.
But they can go in a straight line, and that's the key issue.
So now, for example, in my field, control experiments are so essential. You've obviously, therefore, taken these little guys, these dung beetles, for example, and placed caps on them. And tell us about your experiences, say, at the planetarium, because there you are able to, quote-unquote, fool them, conduct control experiments and the like. What happens when you do this? What happens, for example, when you obscure the Milky Way? What happens when the Milky Way is visible but you put caps on? Please tell us about the control experiments, because after all, it's only in the world of after control experiments are conducted that one can actually make highly definitive scientific hypotheses and statements.
Yeah, absolutely. So with the sun and the moon, we were able to block them by shading them and using a mirror to manipulate their position. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we could reflect mm-hmm. the moon from a completely different angle. The Milky Way is too big. You cannot fiddle with that in the field. So we went to the Wits Planetarium, and the lady that runs it is a lady called Claire Flanagan.
Mm-hmm.
And can you imagine when you go into this beautiful arena with this instrument, which was built in 1938, and you say to somebody, can I bring my dung beetles into your...
It's hilarious.
And she, yeah.
It's hilarious.
She was just so enthusiastic. It
mm-hmm.
was... So before we even get into the science of it, the thrill for us to go into a planetarium, you're probably used to it, but for
yes.
us to conduct an experiment
yes.
in a planetarium
yes.
was blissful.
Yes, and especially carrying your little beloved beetles.
Well, that's it.
Yes.
Because it's ridiculous on top of everything
yes,
else.
Yes, absolutely, it
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
And so lead us through what you did and the control experiments and what you found, Marcus.
So going into the planetarium allowed us to manipulate the sky pretty
right.
much any way we liked.
Right.
And principally what we were able to do was take the Milky Way in and out of the sky.
Yes.
And we could take the stars in and out of the sky.
Yes.
And so what we did was we set up, the first thing was to find out whether they responded to the sky of the planetarium in the
yes.
same way as they did to the sky
yes.
in the field.
Yes.
Absolutely. They cannot tell the difference. Statistically, they are exactly the same.
Hmm.
So they obviously enjoy a planetarium as much as we do.
That's extraordinary. Mm.
And then what we did is we took the Milky Way out of the sky, mm-hmm. and they were able to navigate, not quite as well, but not significantly slower or
mm-hmm.
less accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Put the Milky Way back and took all the stars out,
mm-hmm.
and they were able to navigate as well as they could with the whole sky.
That's extraordinary.
Yep.
So they actually need the starry vaults above
yep.
as reference points and landmarks. And once they have those landmarks, they can start moving their balls of dung.
Yeah. And then what we did is we took out the Milky Way and all the dim stars. So there were 18 bright stars left in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And they got lost. They couldn't do it because they cannot resolve those tiny points of light.
I see.
So they didn't have this sweep of light intensity across the sky. The dots didn't do them any good.
No. So in other words, they actually need, you almost need the diffusivity of the Milky Way, the vast sprawling arch of the Via Lactea. And then you are telling our listeners today that beetles can actually orientate themselves and navigate through the African bush by means of the stars. I find that extraordinary. How difficult is it to put caps onto these little guys' eyes? I mean, they're not that big.
No, it's quite difficult. You need a steady hand and a lot of patience and some particularly sticky glue. We actually stick it onto their backs.
Yes.
Because I talked about the middle section of the body. And so we get, it's like a golf cap. And you stick it onto the onto that middle thorax and it projects over the head.
Yes.
And then blocks their view of the sky.
Yes.
So you've got to have a bit of patience. And as you know, you've got to repeat the experiment over and over again with different individuals to prove that it's not just one individual.
Mm-hmm.
But it's part of the fun because it's, again, ridiculous putting a hat on a beetle. But at the same time, you know the result you want. And when it comes, it's delightful.
Yes, yes. Folk, we're listening to dung being a tight market. We are listening to the awesomeness of beetles, dung beetles, navigating by means of the Milky Way, by means of the vast arch so brilliantly seen in the southern hemisphere. But then our guest, our distinguished guest this afternoon, Professor Marcus Byrne, has also done some very sophisticated experiments, not only using the Milky Way, but in looking at some of his recent publications. One is entitled, "The Diurnal Dung Beetles Use the Intensity Gradient and the Polarization Pattern of the Sky for Orientation." Now, that's taking one to a totally different level. It's one thing for you and I to understand that the dung beetles are using the arch of the Milky Way for orientation. But when it comes to highly sophisticated concepts, such as the intensity gradients of the sky and then polarized light, please just take us through those concepts, first of all, for those listeners who do not have a scientific background, of intensity gradient, of polarization, and then how do these little guys, these little dung beetles, use intensity gradients and polarized light as landmarks as they traverse the African soil?
Well, the bottom line is the sun is not always available. The moon is not always available. So that it could have either set, or it could be behind a cloud, or it could be behind a very cloudy sky. So effectively what these guys have got is a fallback system. So they have a backup navigation system. And it's a literally hierarchical. The sun's at the top of it. And then if that's not available, they go to the next best, and they go to the next best, and the next best. So the intensity gradient of the sky is something that you and I can see, but it's not that clear.
Of course.
But where the sun is, the sky is brighter. And where the sun is not, the sky is darker. And again, we can manipulate these guys because they are so tractable. They're so determined to push their ball in a straight line, that if you switch the intensity gradient of the sky around, so it goes against the way the sky is, the prediction would be that they would change direction by 180 degrees.
Yes.
And what do? They do exactly that. So again,
that's extraordinary.
Yeah, very simple experiment, very simple, straightforward answer.
Oh.
Now, polarized light is a little bit more complex because you and I can't see it, and it's because of the way our eye is built. But essentially, it's light all moving in one plane. And the easiest analogy is to imagine light coming through a fence, a grating, and only the light that is parallel to the lines of the grating actually comes through.
Right.
So you've effectively got lines that look like the lines on the ceiling. And imagine somebody swimming backstroke in an indoor swimming pool. That's how guys make sure they swim in a straight line, is they follow the lines on the ceiling.
Very good.
And that's pretty much what the dung beetles do, is they follow the lines on the ceiling, except this time it's the polarized light pattern in the sky. that emanates, well, it comes from the dust in the sky, but it is centered around the sun.
Mm.
So as the sun hits the horizon, that polarized light pattern is in a north-south direction.
And the beetles follow that?
Well, they don't follow it like they don't follow the sun. They use it as a cue, but at least, even though we can't see it, we as biologists know that there's a north-south orientation to the sky. So what we do then is we put down a big filter that is at right angles to the sky. So we give them a
false cue.
Yeah, an east-west orientation. Yes. And our prediction would be that they'll do a right angle turn.
Correct.
And what they do is they go under our sky, our false sky, and hey presto, they turn right.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's incredible. I mean, given that one can hold these tiny little beetles in your hand, one would never expect a priori that their receptors are so sensitive to be able to detect the direction, the delineation of polarized light. That is extraordinary. What you're saying to us is if you change the orientation of the patterns of polarized light, they too, by say 90 degrees, pi on 2 radians, they too will change direction. That is a remarkable connection between the dung beetle and the cosmos. But not only the cosmos, but polarized light. I mean, understanding what it means, I'm absolutely enthralled by your experiments because that is really exceptional.
Thanks. And the best thing is they're good fun. You know, that we have a great time doing it. And what's nice is we're able to take it further now. We're following the track of the sensors into the eye and then from the eye into the brain.
Yes.
So this tiny brain that we talked about with 350,000 neurons, they don't have any spare computing capacity. So we're literally tracking down the neurons in the brain that are sensitive to the polarized light or are sensitive to UV light or are sensitive to green light. And we can literally find them and identify them and test how they work.
Amazing. Now, just before we have a little music break, Marcus, suppose there's a listener, for example, in Matric, and they want to come and study, the marvelous mystery of the dung beetle at WITS in Johannesburg with you and under your expert guidance. What sort of subjects do they need to specialize in? What do they need to do? Because this to me, I think if I was doing my doctorate over again, I probably would certainly study under you. I find it absolutely a remarkable connection between the cosmos and these little guys. What does a student actually need to specialize in?
Biology would be useful, but to be honest, and it's my subject, I think biology is a subject that you can pick up fairly easily if you have the passion for it.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom line, to be absolutely boring, you've got to have the maths and the English. And it's the maths is one of my weak points as a scientist.
I see.
And I still regret it at the age of 55, that my maths is so work on the maths.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say that.
So a good maths background, yes.
Yeah. English, because you have to communicate. And then obviously the sciences would be useful: biology, physics, chem.
Yes.
And imagination and excitement. That's the thing that you need.
Is passion.
Exactly.
As I've often said, Marcus, passion is never taught, it is caught. So you're listening to Professor David Block. Studio number 0861-555-189 to reach us on WeChat at Cliff Central. We have an interesting question before our music break, and that is the following. And our distinguished guest in the studio today is Professor Marcus Byrne from the University of the Witwatersrand. And he is an absolute world-renowned expert in the world of entomology, in the world of beetles, in the world of insects, in the world of dung beetles. In fact, I'm sure most of our listeners have heard of TED, the incredible TED. If you do not know TED, just Google it and see that some of the most distinguished subjects have been addressed on the TED by or in TED talks. and Professor Marcus Byrne delivered a TED talk in 2012, which I simply love and adore, entitled The Dance of the Dung Beetle. Duncan, doesn't that excite you? The absolute, the dance, the actual dance of the dung beetle. I think that is extraordinary. And certainly to appear on the world stage of TED is absolutely remarkable. Our question, one of the questions are flowing in. The next question is, Professor Byrne, how is global warming hindering the navigation of the dung beetles?
Great question. And I'm obviously, as a speaker, I'm going to hive off at an angle on that, but I'll answer it first. The short answer is we don't know yet, but it's almost bound to, because as rainfall patterns shift and temperature shifts, it will affect the insects.
Well, I see.
And dung beetles are strictly driven by rainfall, and in fact when you were talking about them appearing in June, they won't appear in June here because it doesn't rain. They're literally coming on stage now, and they'll be with us through to March, April, and then as the rain goes away, then they will go away. But I think what's just as important, and it fits in with our discussion, is that the other thing that's affecting them is light pollution. So as the world becomes brighter and brighter, and we are profligate with light, you know, we waste it.
Absolutely.
We are going to now embark on some research with dung beetles, because again, we know the animal so well, we know what it needs in terms of light cues to orientate. And we think that the light pollution might also affect the way they navigate.
So in other words, given the fact that very few people today actually might see the Milky Way, as I perhaps am privileged to do at some of the world's observatories, great observatories, in the middle of the Atacama Desert and elsewhere, what you're saying is that if light pollution becomes a serious problem, the beetles will certainly, their navigation patterns could be severely affected. Am I understanding you correctly?
Absolutely right. And so that's what we're now embarking on now, is to see what the effect of light pollution is on their navigational behavior.
And then another question yet again, but we've answered this one. Does the dung beetle only feast on dung? And Professor Marcus has clearly told us that that's just one of the elements in which they actually feast. But we are just going to take a two-minute break, again playing some of my favorite music by Antonio Vivaldi and The Four Seasons, The Beetle and The Four Seasons. Okay. You're back with Professor David Block interviewing Professor Marcus Byrne, a world-renowned expert on dung beetles and the navigation by means of the stars, amongst many other topics. Now, we have an interesting question, and that's very basic, and I'll put it in the tone in which the question was phrased. And that is regarding human poo. So, in other words, not poo necessarily from an elephant. Would it help, for example, if there was, say, human poo somewhere, to get a family of dung beetles to help us clean up the pooey mess? Being a father of twin boys, I know that poo can be found everywhere, including on the walls. My twins specialized in using poo as the medium in which they decorated the glowing walls of the apartment in which, or the rooms in which we were staying while visiting friends. We found Picasso poo marks spread everywhere. So if I had these dung beetles you've brought along, Marcus, could they actually have assisted me in cleaning up the pooey twin scenario?
In short, no. Dung beetles do go for human dung.
Yes.
And they love it because it's very like pig dung.
I see.
I hate to tell you, because we're omnivores.
Yes.
And it is extremely attractive. But the best analogy I can come up with is people often ask, can they use dung beetles in their garden to clear up the dog dung?
Yes.
And if you go and poke around in your garden, particularly at this time of the year, under the poo, you will find beautiful little holes. It looks like someone's pushed a pencil into the soil underneath the dung, underneath mm-hmm. the dropping. And that's where a beetle has gone down and removed a portion of the dung. But unfortunately, there just aren't enough of them in an urban environment to do the job completely.
I see.
And the guys they're competing with are the flies. And the filth flies, like house flies and blowflies, are in much quicker. They lay their eggs in massive numbers. Mm. And they will utilize the dung much more rapidly than the beetles will.
Mm.
So I always tell people, dog poo, pick it up, stick it in a plastic bag and put it in the rubbish. It really is the only way to deal with the flies.
Mm.
And if you were to go out and defecate in the garden thinking that you're doing the dung beetles a favour, well, you and the neighbours aren't going to enjoy it the next time you have a braai, because you'll have flies for Africa.
Yes. Now, I'm very interested, of course, we know that all our listeners might spend a lot of their time, as we discussed in the previous broadcast, selecting a mate for life or for a period of time. Now, we've been concentrating on dung beetles and the way they navigate by means of the sun, the stars, light intensities, and polarized light. But of course, I'm sure that dung beetles also feel the need to have a mate. Is there any specific way that you have discovered, Marcus, in which they actually select their mates? We are talking about mating and the world of dung beetles. Over to you, Marcus.
And of course, thanks, David, it revolves around dung, because, again, it's their mission in life. So not only do they use it as a vehicle for their genes, as I said, they lay an egg in it, and then the egg hatches into a larva, the larva feeds on the dung, and then develops into a new beetle. The adult beetle also feeds on the dung, so it's its food source. And it also uses it as a nuptial gift. So it uses it as a present for their girlfriend.
Hmm.
So instead of a box of chocolates or a bunch of roses,
how extraordinary,
a little ball of poo is constructed. Again, it depends on the species.
Hmm.
And the one particular species I like, the male makes a very shallow tunnel, so about 2 or 3 centimeters below the ground.
Hmm.
Buries not a big ball as his little gift to his girlfriend, and then he comes to the top of the hole and he releases a pheromone. So a pheromone is like a hormone, except it leaves the body. So hormones are chemical messengers that stay in the body, and pheromones are chemical messages that leave the body. And this message is, how about a good time?
Yeah.
Here I am, box of chocolates, come and, hey baby, come and have a good time. And so the female picks up the scent if she's ready to mate. And she flies in and copulates with him. And then she goes down to the end of the tunnel and eats the box of chocolates. But as a father of daughters, I always tell the girls that they must check out the chocolates before they make any commitments. Because believe it or not, some of the dung beetles cheat. And the male makes a little tunnel, releases his pheromone, but he doesn't put a ball at the bottom of it, which I find astonishing, and particularly as a man, that you think men can be bad, but even dung beetles can be bad.
So there's the tunnel, but there's no gift.
No gift at the bottom of it. And she gets duped into giving herself to this guy, and there's no reward.
That is absolutely extraordinary. Listeners, imagine the following scenario. You are going on a date, and you're wanting to present your beloved with some precious gift. As Marcus has said, some of us might go and choose roses or proteas or boxes of chocolates or maybe a box of mangoes or whatever attracts the mate, perhaps some fragonard from Paris. But what we are suggesting, we know Sia here is looking for a mate, is that Sia needs to collect poo. Sia then has to roll the poo up into a ball. Sia then has to present this ball, first of all, tunnel in his garden, take his beloved to the tunnel, and tell his beloved, "Oh, my beloved, I have something exceedingly special to show you today. Behold, I have the most awesome gift to give thee." And at the end of the tunnel will be this poo, which Sia has rolled up into a spherical ball. But I find it remarkable, Marcus, seriously speaking, that these little insects not only navigate by means of the stars, but, I mean, can attract mates in rather sophisticated ways. Yes, their currency is poo, but I find it phenomenal how sophisticated they really are.
They are, you're right, they're incredible organisms, and this is why it's worth us studying them, because it appears trivial and it's entertaining and it's lovely to discover things about nature. But the bottom line is that these little guys are doing very sophisticated things on minimal brain power. And we can learn from them, and we will build robots one day that do exactly this.
The world of robotics. Yep. You've been listening to Professor Marcus Byrne, who has his honours degree, BSc Honours, London, his doctorate from the University of the Witwatersrand, world-renowned expert and a TED speaker on entomology. He teaches zoology, but he's an expert, a world-renowned expert, on the world of dung beetles and navigation by means of the stars. This is Professor David Block signing off to the sound, the background movements of Antonio Vivaldi. Until next week, I bid you goodbye.